It has a certain disciple named Tabitha. I don't think that changes anything all that much. But it's almost like everybody knows who we're talking about when you see something like that. I think it's also said about some others in the King James Version. But Acts chapter 9, verse 36 is where we find our text. Now in Joppa, there was a disciple named Tabitha, which translated in Greek is called Dorcas. This woman was abounding with deeds of kindness and charity, which she continually did. And she's called Tabitha or Dorcas down through the rest of the chapter. When you think about the difference of congregations and how congregations, what they consist of, even the one like there at Joppa, they're made up of common people who oftentimes prove to be extraordinary characters. And I think that's the case with Tabitha. Now, Tabitha or Dorcas was one character who flashes across a little bit of the New Testament and flashes like a comet in the night sky. She's briefly seen but brightly shines. And whereas Tabitha is more commonly known as Dorcas, the one name, Tabitha, is Aramaic and Dorcas is Greek. Both names mean gazelle. But there are several lessons that we can learn from this account. We might have, on occasion, run into someone named Tabitha. Likely, though, you haven't run into anybody named Dorcas, although in the church out in Parkersburg, there was a lady there by the name of Dorcas. So even nowadays, you can find someone like this. But when we think about the report about Dorcas, now, one of the things that you find is that she was someone who was abounding with deeds of kindness and charity, which she continually did there in verse 36. And I think about this, that actually that's the way Christians are supposed to be. Without a lot of fanfare, oftentimes just doing the things that are necessary to do. Titus chapter 2 and verse 14 tells us something along this line, where it says there, in relationship, first of all, to Jesus, who gave himself for us to redeem us from every lawless deed and to purify him for himself. Now this is what we want to see. A people for his own possession who are zealous for good deeds, who are zealous for good works. And that's the way we should be, zealous for those. Not, I think sometimes too much maybe that we get too zealous for the praise that goes with this, but that's not what it should be. It should just be, you know, for the works. It's something that needs to be done, and it gets done. Now, good works, you talk about something that sometimes can just be wide open as to what good works are. But I think if you go over to 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 16, where it talks about how all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and how it's profitable for instruction in righteousness, for reproof, for a number of things, that the man of God may be thoroughly furnished for every good work. So it's the Scriptures that tell us what good works are, not what we might think, but what the Scriptures have to say about this. So I'm thinking that there she was, involved in good works, charitable deeds. It's what you should be doing. But she's doing things that are in line with what the Scriptures teach. Now, specifically, when you get down to verse 39, you find out what she's doing. I don't think that this is all that she was doing, but it's one of the things that's a feature of her. She was making clothing for the widows. It says the tunics. Now that That's sometimes translated as coats, sometimes as robes. Along that line, it's a multi-use garment, I guess is how you would look at it. But not just the tunics, but other garments as well that she used to make. And these were those that were widows, less fortunate, and so on. And in Acts chapter 20 and verse 35, there's the admonition there, and it's attributed to the Lord, you know, to remember the poor. And so that's something that we ought to do. Remember those that are less fortunate. I think Tabitha would be remembered among the living as she was, and also remembered before God for the things that she did. Sometimes we think, well, it's just such a small thing and so on, but small things sometimes are the things that are remembered and are things that still need to be done. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 20, it says, "Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in or steal." Now just think about this, storing up for yourselves treasures in heaven, which is what Dorcas was doing. Small things, some would say insignificant, well, whatever they would want to say. But she was doing this, and she would be remembered for that. There's lots of people like that. I remember the woman that came and threw in two mites in the treasury when everybody else was throwing in more and making great fanfare over it. And it says she'll be remembered because she did what she could do. And there's another example of laying up treasures in heaven. But then, back in Acts chapter 9 and verse 37 through 39, Tabitha died and was prepared for burial and was mourned. It happened at that time that she fell sick and died. And when they had washed her body, they laid it in an upper room. And since Lydda was near Joppa, the disciples, having heard that Peter was there, sent two men to him, imploring him, "Do not delay in coming to us." So Peter arose, went with them, and when he arrived, they brought him into the upper room, with all the widows stood before him, weeping and showing all the tunics and garments that Dorcas used to make while she was with them. Peter came to Joppa, didn't he? And he came there from Lydda. Now, if you start back in verse 32, you find out why he happened to be there in Lydda. And from what I'm able to tell, the disciples, when they sent They're at Joppa where Tabitha's at, and they send, and it's about 12 miles from Lydda to Joppa as the crow flies, so to speak. So they send for him. They want him to come. And I really think that he's come there with the idea of to comfort them as they mourned for Tabitha's passing. Now, you can find a lot of ideas and a lot of speculation as to why they sent for Peter in particular. And it never says as to why. Some will say, well, they brought him there for the purpose of raising Tabitha. Well, I think that's what happens, but I don't think necessarily that's why he came. I remember that we're studying it on Sunday morning, that Stephen was stoned there in Jerusalem. And all the disciples, the apostles, a lot of them would still have been there at the time. And they didn't go over to raise Stephen or anything like that. So it's not just a given that that's what the purpose was. I think more it's something that happened. Think about that. But his coming would offer them a certain amount of comfort and so on. And one of the things that's common to the gospel is to offer words of comfort. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, it seems to me, and I know that I do this, but verses 13 through 18, it seems like a lot of times these are read like, I always read them at a graveside service. I think they'd be good at other times as well, not just at that particular time. First Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13 through 18, we do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, so that you will not grieve, as do the rest who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we shall always be with the Lord. Now watch verse 18. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. And the words offer comfort to the living. That's what they're for. And these aren't the only words that offer something like this. And it appears at this time that there were some there in Thessalonica, and this isn't just the only occasion, but there were some that were saying that, that the Lord's going to return, but only going to return for the living. Well, what about those who are gone, who have passed away? And so this is something that straightens this out. No one's going to be left out. All have the opportunity when the Lord returns to join him in the clouds. Now, there's some that go in a certain order, but all do. Those that have gone on, the dead in Christ, they'll rise first, and then others after that. So they offer words of comfort, and they would be good to hear words like this that were said about Dorcas, Tabitha. And I think another thing that we ought to remember is that whenever we need comfort, where are we going to turn? Well, I like to think that we can turn to our brethren and that they can offer comfort. I often think about someone who needed some comfort. Think about Job. If ever there was somebody that needed comfort, he did. And his wife did too. Not just Job particularly, but he had some friends that came, and you think to yourself that they came, why did they come there? Age old question, isn't it? You would think that they came to offer words of comfort, but it seems like they had more words of accusation than they did comfort toward Job. And there was a time where it said that they didn't utter a sound. They just sat there with Job. Just sat there. And I think about that, and that would be a good thing. Sometimes there are times when we're not listening. Not that we're, shutting other people out or anything like that. We just, the grief and the sorrow can be so great that you don't hear what's being said. But you kind of know that somebody's there. You are aware of that. And these ones are there, and just by their presence, I suppose that would mean a lot. I think it does on other occasions. It's meant a lot to us just that people would come in times like this. But with Job's friends, I think it would have been better off if they'd have just stayed quiet and never opened their mouths. Because after that, it seems to me that comfort went out the window so to speak. I mean, all their speeches, you know, were just gone. And the one, the last one, it was almost like, well, the rest of you, you haven't really hit the nail on the head. I will. I'll really let it out now. And, you know, Job has to listen to all this. And I just think to myself, the point where Job tells them that they've been miserable comforters. I think, yeah, that's almost an understatement when you think about all of it. But we ought to be able to turn to at least to someone for some comfort, even if it's just to be there and to sit with you, not to say anything. I think 1 Corinthians chapter 12 tells us something about this. You might turn over there. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, starting in verse 12, it says, "Even as the body is one and yet has many members, and all the members of the body, though they are many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greek, whether slaves or free, and were all made to drink of one Spirit. For the body is not one member, but many. If the foot says, 'Because I am not a hand, I am not a part of the body,' it is not for this reason, any the less, a part of the body. And if the ear says, 'Because I am not an eye, I am not a part of the body,' it is not for this reason any the less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the hearing be? And if the whole were hearing, where would the sense of smell be? But now God has placed the members, each one of them in the body, just as He desired." And do you see what He's saying? We're all different. We've got different parts, but each part is something that matters. And it's not one that has more honor than the other or anything like that. And as the body is made up of many different parts, you know, so is the church. Drop down to verses 25 through 27. "So that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. Now watch this. If any one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. And you are Christ's body and individually members of it." You know, when we think about this in the light of what we're talking about here with Tabitha, we should turn to each other for comfort. Peter, the rest of them, they need to be in the business of comforting and also being comforted. And this is telling us that we're all part of this. And so we ought to be offering some comfort one to another. And while all this is taking place, there's part of this then. Go back to Acts chapter 9. There's a part of this where something very special happens on this occasion. Tabitha is brought back to life. Just before we look at this and think about it a little bit, and examine a number of things, I just think to myself, what that must have been like. I look at some of the accounts of the dead being raised in the Scriptures, and I just think what it would have been like to have been standing there. And I think about at the tomb of Lazarus as they just viewed it, so to speak. I don't know how far away they were. And to hear them, you know, Jesus say, "Roll away the stone." Something that just wasn't done at this point. Been dead 4 days. But they roll back the stone. And Jesus just calls out, "Lazarus, come forth." And I'm sure that there was a little pause there. I don't think, you know, that Lazarus all wound up in the grave wrappings and everything ran out of there like Jesse Owens, have my doubts. So there's probably a little pause, you know. But can you imagine what it would have been like to have heard Jesus to call out like that, and you're watching over there and he walks out. I just can't imagine. And a number of other things, you know, where that's just what happens. That's what happens here. You know, it's just. I guess it blows out our boggle factor, so to speak, you know, when we consider something like that. Now, the events that were involved in all this are really, they're very simple. They're in verses 40 and 41. Peter sent them all out, knelt down, prayed. Turning to the body, he said, "Tabitha, arise." She opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up. He gave her his hand, raised her up, and calling the saints and the widows, he presented her alive. Imagine what it would have been like to have gone into a room and see her, you know, standing there. Really something. But it's really simple things are done. And when he presents her alive, it's almost like what you find with Elijah. And there was the widow of Zarephath. I wanted to get Zarephath right, and I just blundered on widow. How about that? Anyway, the widow of Zarephath, and, you know, here's your son. And you think about it. And then there's Elisha and the Shunammite woman. Presents the child to the mother. Here they are. And then over here in Luke chapter 7, verse 15, that's a funeral procession that's leaving the city that's known as Nain. And they just they stop the procession. And it was a widow's only child, man-child, that had died. It's believed, you know, young man is what a lot of translations have. But you think about that, and her husband had died, and now her only child, a young man, had died. This puts this poor lady in really dire straits. She's suffering through all of this, and then her future just isn't the best in the world. And Jesus raises him up. He just sits up on the funeral bier, they would call it. They carried him on. I just can't imagine. I think to myself that of the weeping that would have accompanied this and how that stopped or at least dissipated. And then when he sits up, you know, he'd been dead for a while to be prepared, now they're carrying him out. And then to hear the gasps from the people who watched this. And not just the people that came out in the funeral procession, but the people that were with Jesus. It'd really be something, wouldn't it? But anyway, dead sons are presented alive to their mothers. And here's this woman who's presented alive to the people who did indeed love her, loved her a lot. And I think about the healing of the daughter of Jairus. This is found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I've got Mark's account up there. That's in Mark chapter 5. It's in two places. There's kind of an interruption in here. But the one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up. And on seeing Jesus, fell at his feet, implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Please come, lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live." And he went off with him, and a large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. And then you see what happens then is this woman who had this hemorrhage for these years. So there's an interruption in there with her, and she touches the robe of Jesus. The hemorrhage stops, and eventually, though, they're allowed to continue. And then in verse 35, they finally come up to the house of the synagogue official, saying, "Your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore?" But Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, "Do not be afraid any longer, only believe." And he allowed no one to accompany him except Peter, James, John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the synagogue official, and he saw a commotion, people loudly weeping and wailing. And entering in, he said to them, "Why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep." They began laughing at him. But putting them all out, he took along the child's father and mother and his companions and entered the room where the child was. Taking the child by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumai," which translated means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl got up, began to walk. She was about 12 years old. And immediately they were completely astounded. We might add that they were greatly comforted as well. But he gave them the strict orders that no one should know about this. And he said that something should be given her to eat. So there we can see this kind of similar here. What Peter did to what Jesus did. And what some of those others did as well. But then also now just consider for a moment or two, while all these things are miracles and what Peter did was a miracle, just think about how this differs from some of these quote-unquote miracles today. Well, they differ quite a bit. First of all, Peter puts the people out and wants very little commotion and is not looking for glory or anything like that. But now with miracles today, the first thing they've got to do is get a large crowd and create a big commotion. And then with great amount of fanfare, they began to pray. Well, I don't see any of that with any of those in the New Testament that perform miracles. And then today, even when nothing happens, they still expect praise. And a little pay would be nice as well. But it's different. Really different. What this event did in Acts chapter 9, go back there, look at verse 42. "This became known all over Joppa, and many believed in the Lord." So this particular event produced faith. Well, that's what it's supposed to do. You know, the purpose of miracles was not just to astound others. And I've said something about that. And there is an element of every miracle that does show that it's, you know, astonishing. It even goes so far as to say that sometimes. We looked at last week about the catch of fish, and they were astounded, you know, by the catch of fish. I think the one over in John that, maybe we made a connection last week, but you know, when they went fishing and had that catch of fish in John 21, the emphasis there is not on the number of fish, but the size of them, which they determine is unusual. So there is a measure of astonishment that goes on there, but that's not what it's all about. That's not it. It is to produce faith. In Mark chapter 16, and verse 20. "There were those that went out, preached everywhere. While the Lord worked with them, he confirmed the word by the signs that followed." Confirmed the word. This is the truth. That's what it is. And these miracles show that it is the truth. I wonder when these modern day people are out there and they're all prepared, got everybody all ginned up for a miracle and it doesn't happen, what happens to the faith? Of course, that's what they blame it on. They blame it, but well, there wasn't enough faith there. And that's why, you know, it didn't happen. But I think to myself, well, you know, that's kind of a convenient answer. I think about Lazarus being raised from the dead. How much faith does a dead man have? I don't think he's got very much. What do you say the other people? It doesn't seem like there were very many people that were aware of what Jesus was about to do. So I don't think the faith was all that great. That's just a cop-out answer. Hebrews chapter 2. In Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 4, God was also testifying with them both by signs and wonders and by various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit according to His own will, according to the will of God, not the will of man. It's about the words that were spoken, and these words are there to produce faith. These words were never used as a means of physical or material gain. Though that might often be the case today, that's not what they were in the New Testament. Now, at the end of this, back there in chapter 9 of Acts, it says, Peter stayed many days in Joppa with a tanner named Simon. It's kind of interesting that he stayed with the man who was a tanner. Those who were tanners, their occupation made them ceremonially unclean. You can't be a tanner and not handle dead animals. And so, but he's staying with this particular individual. And that's where he's at when it leads up to the events there in chapter 10, the events over at Cornelius' house. They tell him, you go fetch Peter. He's at Joppa and in the house of Simon the tanner. And that's how it kind of ends. It almost ends with minimal fanfare, but a lot's accomplished. And I really think that in all this, you can take songbooks, turn to songs been selected. In all of this, it caused us to consider a few things. Now, one of them is Dorcas was known for the works that she did. And am I doing the works revealed by the New Testament? Am I doing things that are maybe small things, but they matter a great deal? And doing it without fanfare. I don't think that, I think sometimes we might be surprised at what someone's doing and so on. Well, we're not supposed to advertise. We're not supposed to, sound a trumpet every time we do something. Then another thing is, would brethren mourn my passing? Everybody's got a legacy, a name, whether worthy or not, so on it goes. And then would brethren rejoice to see me again? I guess that goes along with the other question, doesn't it? But then also, do I love this world so much that I might forget about the one that's to come? Well, that's something to consider as well. But it's a good lesson to learn from someone who doesn't get a whole lot of fanfare sometime, which was our point tonight. But much of the gospel message and much of the things in the Bible are about people that are kind of behind the scenes, but that are necessary for things to happen, to take place, Tabitha being one of them. And she was someone who was a disciple, a Christian, which means that she had at one point in her life believed that Jesus Christ was the Son of God and repented of her sins and had been baptized. You can become a child of God the same way, disciple, just like Tabitha. If we can help you to do that, why don't you come all together, we stand and sing.